This is what it looks like to drive through Wyoming for about 400 miles. About the only thing you'll see during the first 4.5 hours are the towns of Rock Springs and Rawlins, populations 23,000 and 8,000, respectively. Hopefully, you aren't prone to boredom, because, quite frankly, there's nothing to see. Despite being larger than the United Kingdom, Wyoming is home to less than 600,000 people, about 17% of 1% of the US population. And this emptiness is no accident. Sponsored by Nebula, the exclusive home to my original series, China Actually. Stay tuned for a new episode coming soon. Coal is the lifeblood of Wyoming. The cowboy state alone produces 40% of America's supply, 3 times more than second place West Virginia, and over 50% more than all of Appalachia. The North Antelope Rochelle mine in the state's northeast corner is the largest open-pit coal mine in the world. It operates on 2 12-hour shifts, rain or shine, 365 days a year. Without it, the economy, and indeed the Wyoming way of life, would soon collapse. Though not, as you might assume, for lack of jobs. Truth be told, there are only about 5,000 coal miners left in the state. The loss of these high-paying jobs certainly wouldn't help, but even the incomprehensibly massive North Antelope mine only employs about 1,100 people, 0.1% of the state's population. No, the real reason Wyoming needs coal are severance taxes. For every $100 worth of coal, oil, and gas produced in the state, between $6 and $6.50 are siphoned into the public purse, creating an enormous budget surplus. Rather than redistribute this wealth directly as annual dividends, as Alaska does, the people of Wyoming have chosen low taxes. In any given year, its average household pays only about $3,500 in property, sales, and use taxes, but receives about $27,000 worth of services, including education, healthcare, and infrastructure. In other words, Wyoming residents receive an 80 to 90% discount on public services, all thanks to fossil fuels. But this unusual arrangement has some unusual implications. Imagine you move to, say, North Dakota. This line represents your contributions to the state in the form of taxes, and this one the services you receive in return. What this graph by the economist Dr. Peter Evangelicus shows is that new residents have a slightly positive effect on the state budget. On average, and in the vast majority of states, newcomers give more than they take. Now let's say you move to nearby Wyoming. There, you'd still consume one person's worth of resources. Yet, because its tax rates are so low, you wouldn't add much additional revenue. New residents are a massive drain on its budget. Coal is finite. The larger the population, the less pie is left for everyone. Simply put, its taxpayers have a uniquely strong incentive to keep their state empty. While nearly every region of America has slowly urbanized, including red states like Arkansas, Texas, and Idaho, Wyoming stands apart as one of the last true remnants of the Wild West. In 1980, it was the 49th most populous state in the Union. Today, it's the 50th. In those 40 years, its net population grew by just 2,552 people a year on average. There is no Austin, Texas, island of liberalism, or Bentonville, Arkansas, pocket of urban growth. Every inch of Wyoming remains just Wyoming. And this resistance to change is not limited to demographic growth. Take clean energy, for example. In the last 15 years, wind farms have rapidly proliferated across the United States, and not just including, but especially in traditionally red states like Texas, Oklahoma, and Kansas. But not Wyoming. Between 2011 and 19, the amount of wind power generated by the Cowboy State actually decreased by nearly 10%, as few new turbines were built while many were taken out of service. In a 2023 survey of 8 western states, 5 red and 3 blue, Wyoming was the only one where a majority of respondents preferred to maximize, not reduce, the need for coal, oil, and gas. Wyoming makes Montana look like a bastion of Prius-driving liberals. But all this may be about to change. On August 30th, 2022, it became clear California was about to experience one of its hottest weeks in history. 100-plus degree temperatures were forecast every day for the greater Los Angeles region, home to nearly 20 million Americans. Extreme heat would surely lead to extreme use of air conditioning, one of the biggest consumers of electricity. This line represents energy use on a typical summer day. This one, the record for all of 2021. And these, actual usage between August 31st and September 6th last year. At the same time, electricity supply was seriously constrained. Blistering temperatures led to droughts. Droughts led to wildfires. And wildfires to smoke, which reduced the efficiency of solar panels by roughly 30%. Droughts also brought water levels to record lows in reservoirs across the state, including the Hoover Dam's Lake Mead, a major source of power for Southern California. If this unusually large demand looked as though it might exceed this unusually low supply, even momentarily, state officials would have no choice but to initiate blackouts. And on Tuesday, this nightmare scenario seemed inevitable. By late afternoon, Sacramento, San Jose, Santa Rosa, Redwood City, Livermore, Napa, and King City had all tied or broken their all-time heat records. Sports games were canceled, recess was held inside, and BART trains operated at reduced speeds in case tracks were warped by heat. A few minutes before 5, as Californians began returning home from work, demand for electricity set a new state record, flirting with the edge of supply. In a panic, Governor Gavin Newsom sent an emergency text message begging residents to reduce their usage. Either thousands of households would voluntarily turn down their ACs on the hottest day of the year, or the state was about to experience its third major blackout in 20 years. It worked. Barely. Within minutes, about 2,000 megawatts of demand disappeared, narrowly averting crisis. But harder times lie ahead. Like many states, California is planning for a clean energy future. By 2026, half of its electricity must come from renewable sources, followed by 60% in 2030 and 100% by 2045. That means a greater reliance on solar and hydropower, both of which are weakened at the precise moment energy use is at its highest, hot summer days. To achieve its climate goals without repeating the events of last September, California needs help. In short, there's a huge market for the right kind of energy at the right time of day. And Wyoming, it turns out, has just what California needs. Cruel, relentless wind is a fact of life in Wyoming. Its narrow mountain ranges and high plateaus create thousands of natural funnels for jet streams, which blow wind eastward across the United States. When these funnels are perpendicular to highways, as is the case here on I-25 south of Wheatland, winds can so violently strike the side of a car or semi-truck as to flip it over. This happens surprisingly frequently, as seen in this video, which resulted, miraculously, in zero injuries. With its high-altitude prairie and sparse human habitation, there's simply nothing to slow wind down, allowing it to reach 65 miles an hour or faster, at which point roads are typically closed. While this effect creates some white-knuckle driving, it's perfect for wind farms. Wind speeds are classified between 1, poor, and 7, superb. Half of all 6 and 7 class wind in the nation is located in Wyoming, and most of that in just a few counties around the state's southeast corner. Not only that, but its wind is strong when California's is the weakest, right here in the afternoon. And when the sun is down on the west coast, the Wyoming wind is working overtime. This unlikely alliance between the country's largest and one of its most liberal states and its smallest, most conservative one has the power to radically transform the American West. The only thing that stands in the way is an arduous, bureaucratic maze of federal, state, and county regulations. In 2010, the state of Wyoming reclassified wind farms as industrial facilities, requiring that they go through the same permitting process as those involving, for example, radioactive waste. Only after submitting a 400-plus page application, paying up to $100,000 in fees, and holding a public hearing can a wind developer proceed to step 2, submitting another application, this time to the county. At any point in this process, any person or organization with a Wyoming address can challenge the permit, giving NIMBYs free rein to slow or halt progress. Then there's the federal bureaucracy. No fewer than 6 such departments administer Wyoming land, mainly the Bureau of Land Management. In the 1880s, the U.S. government incentivized the construction of new railroads by granting those companies land on either side of the tracks, in hopes that this land would then be sold to individual settlers rather than large companies. It was given to the railroads in alternating square mile sections. The result is a checkerboard of public and private land in windy southern Wyoming. Since 4 squares of BLM land surround every 1 patch of private land, dealing with the feds is simply unavoidable. Add all this up, and any attempt to tap into this treasure trove of wind power should be dead in the water. Who would gamble hundreds of millions of dollars in upfront costs alone in the hopes that America's most conservative state would sign off on clean energy, and that not one of a dozen counties or hundreds of landowners would veto the project? Enter billionaire oil tycoon, Republican mega donor, and future owner of America's largest wind farm, Philip Anschutz. His plan is to build 1,000 turbines capable of powering 1 million homes on 320,000 acres in a place named for coal, Carbon County. A $3 billion, 700-mile transmission line will then connect this wind farm to California through Colorado, Utah, and Nevada. It took 18 years to secure the permits, but approval was finally granted, against all odds, this spring. Today, after a 10-year stagnation, Wyoming wind is making a comeback. About 8 other farms are in development, with most set to become operational in the next 2 years. Only one question remains: will the people of Wyoming allow it? In the 1970s, the term National Sacrifice Zone was coined to describe places like Wyoming. Out here, on the country's remote frontier, a few Americans would endure the sight, smell, and symptoms of coal so that many more could enjoy its fruits. In return, these areas were well compensated with high salaries and low taxes. But for some, wind represents an unwelcome renegotiation of that implicit trade. According to the University of Wyoming, wind will bring somewhere between 3 and 9,000 jobs to the state, not at all an insignificant amount. The overwhelming majority, however, are short-term construction jobs, building access roads, transporting parts, and installing equipment. In the long term, there may only be 500 to 1,500 operations and maintenance roles, a drop in the bucket compared to coal, oil, and gas. Now, Wyoming residents are powerless to stop the spread of green energy, just as global oil prices have long dictated the state of its economy. But there is one thing they can do: tax it. Wyoming is already the only state in the union with a wind tax. Currently $1 per megawatt hour, several politicians have proposed raising it to $2, $3, $4, or even $5. It's effectively playing a high-stakes game of chicken with wind developers. Wyoming is betting that its wind is so good that investors will swallow the extra cost. And if it works, the tax could breathe new life into Wyoming's dying economy. By introducing a new source of revenue, the state could begin weaning itself off of fossil fuels. But if Wyoming overplays its hand and developers take their money to Colorado or New Mexico instead, its economy could be left more dependent on coal than ever. Perhaps the place in the world most similar to Wyoming is Baotou, China. In fact, it's hard to distinguish these clips of its coal mines from those of Wyoming's North Antelope Mine. Baotou is also, in all likelihood, where the rare earth metals found in the device you're watching this very video on originated. For years, China was accused of artificially subsidizing their production for political control. But the real reason for China's near monopoly is much more complicated. Find out why in my 6-part original series, China Actually, exclusively available on Nebula. Nebula is what happens when channels like Polymatter, Real Life Lore, Real Engineering, and Wendover Productions are given extra resources and freedom from the algorithm. Longer, better, and higher production videos than we could ever make on YouTube. Take a look, for example, at Modern Conflicts. These are 20, 30, 50-minute highly researched deep dives into recent global conflicts. This is an insane amount of premium content, and yet it's just one of dozens of originals, all available for just a few bucks a month. Normally $5 a month, but you can get it for 50% off. That's just $2.50 a month by clicking the link on screen or in the description.